I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. National pundits might have been surprised by Laura Kelly's election night victory in Kansas, but closer observers know the Sunflower State has no problem electing Democratic governors. Today we'll speak with the new governor-elect, who's in Topeka now, wrapping up her state senatorial duties and preparing for a move to the governor's mansion at Cedar Crest. Then, has America failed its middle-class families? We'll hear one perspective on why so many across this country are unable to meet the standard of living they benefited from as children, and now are financially overwhelmed trying to raise children of their own. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas Governor-elect Laura Kelly has been assuming command in Topeka, meeting with outgoing Governor Jeff Collier and making plans to increase school aid and expand Medicaid. Laura Kelly has also announced that she'll be moving to Cedar Crest. That's the governor's mansion on the west side of Topeka. It's been a whirlwind few days for the state senator from Topeka since her surprisingly easy victory over Kris Kobach Tuesday night. Now the governor-elect joins us from her office at the state capitol. And Governor-elect Kelly, so nice to have you, and once again, congratulations.
Thanks, Steve. It's very good to be with you.
You know, you won 48-43%. Was it by a little more than you expected? Because by all means, the public polls leading into Tuesday showed it to be pretty much a dead heat.
Well, you know, if I paid attention to the polls, then yes, I would have expected it to be closer. But, you know, my gut sense just from all of the getting around the state and the crowds that we were drawing and the enthusiasm was just palpable. And so in some ways it didn't surprise me. I think maybe what did surprise me was how soon it was called.
Yes. What's your theory as to why voters finally and ultimately turned your way?
Well, I think our message really did resonate from beginning to end. You know, it was clear to me after the 2016 election that Kansans really wanted to go back to be Kansans. You know, they wanted common sense, moderate leadership that would fund priorities like education. And we started with that message. We stayed with that message. And I think people really got behind it.
I can't help but point out that you won by about 46,000 votes, and you wound up carrying Johnson County by 43,000 votes. That's the state's largest county. Clearly, the county likes you, and maybe a sign that Johnson County is turning a little bit here.
Well, I think we saw that in some of the House races that, you know, and I think having Sharice Davids on the ballot also helped with that. That you know, we were able to sort of piggyback off one another, and you know, a lot of her supporters became mine, and vice versa. And so, but you know, Johnson County, I think more than anything, cares about its schools. Mm-hmm. They were instrumental in 2016 in changing the culture in the legislature. And it was all due to their, desire to support their public school system. And I think they knew that I was the one who would do that. I ran to be the education governor. And so I'm not surprised that they supported me so heavily, because I support the things that they do.
Senator, tell us about the moment when you realized for the first time that you were going to win this thing. I mean, the votes were coming in, they're getting counted. What was the moment?
Well, you know, Steve, I'm Irish Catholic, so I always assume the worst. And you know, don't believe any good news until it's absolutely certain.
Right.
So I was upstairs in the hotel when it was being called, and I just waited until we knew that it was absolutely certain before I would believe that I was really going to be the next governor.
You know, I used this word with Sharice Davids just the other day, but the word surreal has got to apply to a moment like that.
Well, you know, it is. I mean, it's, you know, even though you've worked for the past year to earn the title, mm-hmm. Actually becoming the governor and, you know, recognizing that the people of Kansas voted for me, it was a bit surreal and actually continues to be. But, you know, I think the way I'm dealing with that is just getting to work. Mm-hmm. You know, we have already been heavily engaged in transition. Governor Collier has been incredibly gracious in providing not only his time but space for my team to get into the Capitol and get to work so that, you know, come January 14th, that you know, we won't see a blip. We'll just be able to move from one administration to the other.
Yeah, tell us about that, because I was struck, as so many Kansans were, that Governor Collier, a Republican, had you into his office on Wednesday. You obviously are a Democrat. Was that meeting awkward at all? How did that meeting play out?
No, it really was not awkward. I had talked to Governor Collier a few days before, and I knew that that meeting would be set if I emerge victorious. And, you know, and I've worked with him long enough to know that, you know, he listens and he's interested in policy in the state of Kansas and that, you know, he doesn't want to leave you know, this organization, and you know, he wants to go out on a high note, and I think he's living that out.
What's the toughest thing as one governor hands off administration of the state to another? Is there something that goes on behind the scenes that maybe most citizens would not be aware of, Senator?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of data download that has to be done. You know, we have so many agencies, so many functions, and all of that has to be shifted from, you know, from one group to another. And so there will be a tremendous amount of work going on in the next month or so to make sure that, you know, our administration knows what's going on, knows where budgets are, all of those kinds of things. And we'll be just working very, very closely with the Collier administration to make sure that that data offload goes well.
Laura Kelly, the governor-elect of the state of Kansas, is my guest. At the end of the race, how worried were you that independent candidate Greg Orman could wind up costing you this thing?
You know, Steve, I was never very concerned about that. You know, we thought about that before I decided to run for governor, and we understood that things were very different in 2018 than they were in 2014. The situation is completely different.
The last time you ran statewide, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, and I actually worked on Greg's campaign when he was running for U.S. Senate. But, you know, Kansans react differently to congressional races than they do for statewide races. They're looking for something different, and I thought I had what they were looking for, and I didn't think that they would want to experiment by electing an independent. You know, so I was not terribly concerned about it. Certainly not as concerned as others were.
Is there a place for Greg Orman and a Laura Kelly administration?
You know, if Greg is interested in having that conversation, I would be more than willing to have it. You know, he's not expressed any interest in that yet, but, you know, my door's open.
We talked just before the election about your plans and your intentions to have a bipartisan cabinet. You know the players at the State House pretty well from your years of service there. Are you drawing up lists yet? Have you done any interviews? How does that process roll out?
Well, we're taking names, and yes, we're developing lists, and we will begin vetting people for various positions, and, you know, we do plan on having a bipartisan cabinet, bipartisan appointments, and also an administration that looks like Kansans, so that every Kansan can feel included, and every Kansan can feel like they have a voice at the table.
The other thing about newly elected governors I've noticed over the years, you know, so much has to get done so quickly. It's almost unfair. You need to prepare the budget. You need to hire a cabinet. You need to write a state of the state address. You've got to plan an inauguration. I mean, the logistics here have got to be almost overwhelming.
Well, that's where having a great team comes in. You know, we obviously are planners, I think, you know, given you know the quality of campaign that we ran, we still have people here who know how to get things done and know how to reach out, and so we've already started that process. You know, not that it won't be a whirlwind, but you know, we're used to working at that speed. Have been doing that for the past 11 months, so mm-hmm. You know, now we just have two more months of it, and we're good to go. But there's no doubt, and we want to do it carefully. We don't want to make radical changes just for the sake of making changes. So we will approach it deliberately, but with all due speed, because you're right, it's a short time frame.
Of those, all those tasks I just ticked off here, is there one that strikes you as the most formidable? And does it go without saying that it's preparing the next state budget?
You know, actually, that scares me less. You know, just because I've been on the budget committee for 14 years.
You're so familiar with it, right?
I'm very familiar with the budget, and I've got some other good folks who'll be working with me, and I expect full cooperation from the Collier administration in working on that. So, no, the budget's not it. You know, the thing that I'm most concerned about and that I will put most focus on is finding the right people to bring into the administration to run our agencies and fill our commissions and boards so that we have the very best and the brightest and the best intended folks in those positions, so that we can, you know, start to drill down and really mend our state. You know, as you know, there are a lot of things that are not working particularly well in the state of Kansas right now, and it's going to take an extraordinary set of people who work together to put this all back on track.
I'm just wondering to what extent former Governor Kathleen Sebelius is able to help navigate all of this, these next few weeks that are so critical, because she obviously was instrumental in talking you into this to begin with. So maybe she can come to your aid when things get a little crazy right now.
Well, you know, I'm actually really fortunate to have a number of former governors working with me on this. And yes, their input is very, very helpful. You know, Governor Graves, Governor Hayden, you know, and Governor Sebelius are all providing advice and input that will make it much easier for me than it might have been for them.
That's got to be a comforting kind of set of supporters there at a moment like this.
You bet. You know, I mean, say I don't need training wheels, but it does help to have somebody holding the back of the seat while I'm learning how to drive this here car.
Laura Kelly, the governor-elect of Kansas, is my guest. Job one, you told reporters yesterday, is to increase state aid to public schools and to expand Medicaid. Let's take those one at a time. The state Supreme Court has ordered the legislature to spend more on schools. Do you have an idea yet of what kind of number you're looking at as you go about preparing that next budget?
Well, I think we're probably looking at something between 70 and 100 million. And I'll work with, you know, our budget folks, and we'll figure out exactly what that number is. But I'm very confident that, you know, given the fact that we've had revenues coming in over estimates for the last 17 months, we'll be doing consensus revenue estimating today, I think, is actually when it will come out. So we will have a very good idea about how much we need to put in there and where we can find the money. I'm very sure that it will be available in our ending balance, and that we'll be able to just sweep that money into the education funding account and put that before we'll put it in the budget, and the budget will go to the legislature, and I fully expect that the legislature will cooperate and take care of inflation factor.
So no tax increase required to meet the state Supreme Court orders, what you're suggesting here?
No, there's not, Steve. Not at all. I'm very confident that the money is there and that we'll be able to submit a budget to the legislature that will include the education funding plus the inflation.
The good fortune that you have right now is that revenue is coming in at a good clip. It's actually exceeding expectations. That's a whole lot better than if it was the flip side of the coin.
Oh, you betcha.
I know.
And I want it to spin the other way. And, you know, I mean, that's what happened, you know, since the tax experiment was put into place. And it was painful because, you know, then the budgets that were submitted by the previous administration, you know, included, you know, sweeps of our transportation funds, you know, not making payments to CAPERS, you know, emptying out our pool money investment board as much as we could, you know, getting rid of the Bioscience Authority, eliminating the Arts Commission. All of those things were done to fill the holes in the budget created by the tax experiment. We won't have to do that.
Hmm. You've also talked about expanding Medicaid, the health care program for the poor. The support for such a move, if it exists in the legislature, is probably razor thin at best. Have you had a chance to assess the outcome of the election and whether you still have a shot at getting this through the legislature? Because that issue strikes me as perhaps your first great challenge here.
Yeah, I think we're going to be okay because remember, you know, this time around, last time legislature passed Medicaid expansion, we needed a veto-proof majority. This time we won't. We can do it with a simple majority of 63 in the House, you know, 21 in the Senate, and then I can sign it. So I'm confident that we can get that done. Yeah, I'm not going to tell you that it'll be, you know, piece of cake. I will need to work with the legislature, but, you know, I've done that for 14 years too, and so I'm very confident that I can get in there. And I think the people of Kansas made it very clear that, you know, Medicaid expansion might have been their number two priority, just behind schools.
You know, Republican leaders already are eyeing you with some caution. I want to read you some comments from the Republican leadership in Kansas just in the last couple of days. Senate President Susan Weigel said this, Senator, she'll be very liberal when it comes to spending. House Speaker Ron Reichman is saying that you ran on no new taxes platform, and his chamber will hold you to that. He said this, I've always been told there's no such thing as a free lunch, but that's exactly what Laura Kelly promised folks on the campaign trail. How do you respond to those remarks?
Well, I'm hoping to meet with the leadership in both the House and the Senate and start working together with them. You know, I have done that in the past, and I believe that I can do that in the future. I think that by electing me, Kansans have also made it clear that they want bipartisanship. And so I think we can use that mandate from the public in working with the leadership. You know, they've got to govern too. And, you know, my style has always been to bring everybody around the table, regardless of whether we agree on everything, but then sit down and hammer out something that we could all live with. So I plan to do that with the leadership in both the House and the Senate.
I'm just so struck at a moment like this, hearing you talk about all this morning, about the importance on relationships that you've already established are as you launch your administration here. I mean, imagine if you were a fresh face to state government, as perhaps Eric Greitens was once upon a time, just how difficult it would be to navigate if you didn't know your way around the block.
Well, you know, I thought about that when I came into the Capitol yesterday morning for the first time since I was elected, and thought, wow, this would be really overwhelming if I didn't know where the committee rooms were. I didn't know where the legislator offices were. You know, all of that stuff would be, you know, plus I had no idea about the budget, no idea about policy. And I thought that would be terrifying. It's really reassuring, you know, that I've been here a long time. I know a lot of the faces. I do have relationships with them, you know, including everybody. I mean, the housekeeping staff. It just, it goes on and on and on. So it is reassuring. And I think that's what will allow me to really, you know, get to work now and then, you know, as soon as I'm inaugurated and get things done, because I don't have to get to know these people. They don't have to get to know me. We already know each other.
Yesterday, Governor-elect Kelly, you also announced your first executive order. What's that going to be?
It will be to reinstate the order to ban discrimination against LGBTQ folks in state agencies. So I will have that drafted, and I will have that ready to go as soon as I get in the office.
And that's a reversal of policy that Governor Brownback put in place. Do I have that right?
It was something that Governor Sebelius put into place, and then Governor Brownback rescinded it, and it has stayed that way since. I will change that. And I think that that's going to be incredibly helpful in sending a message to the nation that Kansas is back and that we're welcoming and that we're open for business. And you know, folks who thought never Kansas can now put us back on the radar screen.
You've also talked about two other early priorities. One's reducing the sales tax on food, and then also boosting the amount spent to protect vulnerable kids in Kansas. I'm thinking about kids in the foster care system and elsewhere. How soon can you get those things done?
Well, I will focus on the foster care kids, just because that's a life and death emergency situation, and we have got to do that. Other things, we really need to probably wait until sometime in the middle of next year, certainly till after the April consensus revenue estimates, to have a much better idea about where we are budget-wise and where we're projected to go. And as soon as things are stable and as soon as we have, you know, funded education, taken care of the foster kids, and expanded Medicaid, then the first thing I want to do is look at a way to reduce our food sales tax. It is outrageously, almost immorally high, and we need to do something about that. So that would be my first priority as soon as things are stabilized.
It strikes me as that's an issue where drawing bipartisan support might be very possible.
We've seen that before. You know, it wouldn't be the first time we had voted on reducing the sales tax on food. So I think it will, you know, as long as we can do it without creating budget problems. And that's what I will wait. I will wait until that time comes when the money really is there to do it without having to sacrifice other things.
As you know, Missouri just passed a constitutional amendment to approve medical marijuana in the state. Is that issue ripening now for Kansas to take on?
I will be surprised if that issue doesn't come up in the legislature this year. You know, there was a lot of talk during the campaign about legalization of medical marijuana. There has been chatter around the legislature around that issue also, so I'll be very surprised if it doesn't come up. And I'm actually hoping that it does. I think we need to have that conversation. I think we need to consider that seriously. You know, we know that there are some real benefits to use of marijuana, particularly when we look at the opioid crisis. You know, if folks were able to use, in some cases, if folks were able to use medical marijuana, we could lower the number of opioid prescriptions and keep those things off the streets. So I want the legislature to have that conversation. I think they're ready to do that, and I'll be all in with them as they're discussing it.
Now, just a final point. You and your husband live in Topeka now. You've also announced that you're going to move to Cedar Crest, the governor's mansion on the west side of Topeka. Was that a hard call for you and your husband?
No, not really. I mean, we love our neighborhood. We've been there over 30 years. You know, it doesn't make fiscal sense to keep that home and have Cedar Crest available. So, plus I think it's important for the governor and the governor's family to have a presence there. That is, the Kansans' home for their governor, and I think they want the governor to be there. So I plan to move there as soon as we can.
That's Governor-elect Laura Kelly from Kansas. Governor, all the best to you getting started in this big new endeavor, and sure appreciate you taking some time here.
You're very welcome, Steve. Look forward to talking with you over the next few years.
You bet. All the best, Governor. Time for a break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the squeeze being applied to the middle class of this country. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we visited with Gloria Steinem, the women's rights icon. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Monday is Veterans Day, and we'll feature poetry and prose written by area veterans, as we've done before. Join us Monday for a celebration of Veterans Day as seen through the eyes of veterans. Well, here's an idea that won't surprise hardly any of the adults listening to this program today. You're getting squeezed, and squeezed hard. Childcare costs are eating you up, or maybe it's the cost of health care. And did I mention the ever-rising cost of college for the kids? Maybe you have to work longer hours than you used to, or maybe you don't work regular hours. Paid family leave, are you kidding? The middle class in this country isn't what it used to be. In fact, it's getting squeezed from every side. Alyssa Quart chronicles all this in her latest book, Squeezed: Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Alyssa Quart is executive editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. She's also a 2010 Nieman Fellow at Harvard. Alyssa, what a pleasure to have you. Welcome.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you, Steve.
You begin this book by introducing readers to a woman named Michelle Belmont, who's getting squeezed. The first line of the book is, Michelle Belmont's debt haunted her. Tell us what Michelle was up against here.
So Michelle was a librarian, and she had just given birth to her son, who was like 10 pounds something ounces.
Wow.
I called him, a hefty creature. And after she did that, she started to have to pay additional, medical bills because the pregnancy was somewhat, the birth was somewhat complicated. And then her infant had some medical problems too, but they weren't extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, she had some student debt. That was left over from when she had been a graduate student, and then she was trying to retrain to make herself more attractive in the job market, so she was getting more student debt. And then by the end of that time, she was tens of thousands, I think over $100,000 in debt, and she was living in a one-bedroom apartment with her husband, who worked in IT. And the two of them seemed to me, here you have a technological librarian and somebody works in tech and maybe not the highest level, but he's mm-hmm. working in tech. And yet they were struggling to figure out how to live comfortably with a new child and to not be swamped by debt.
I gather her story is pretty typical.
Yeah, I mean, it's really typical. After the 2008 recession, law firms and corporations retained fewer lawyers, for instance. So you think, like, law? This
right.
is not a profession anyone used to feel sorry for.
Right.
But, in Alaska, only 56% of those with law degree, 56% of those with law degree were not working as lawyers. And actually, in Missouri, it's 50%.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So in your own, backyard.
Right.
And for professors, it's pretty bad, too, although people are used to that. School teachers, I wrote about school teachers who they were unionized, but they were driving Uber on the side because they couldn't pay for their rent or their mortgages without that additional, lift, so to speak.
Right, right.
And and then that meant that they were grading at stop signs, and it was not a fun experience.
Michelle Belmont's story doesn't fit your own, but you and your husband also struggled a bit, and you came to know something about this world. What happened to you guys?
Yeah, I mean, we were freelance journalists, and this is, of course, you're a journalist, a radio journalist, and you know what happened.
Oh, I know how tough that can be. Absolutely.
I mean, it's gotten to the point, and this is, I run this organization called the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, where we give grants often to lower income reporters, including radio reporters, but also photographers and documentarians. And, you know, many of them are struggling. Some of them are on food stamps or can't pay their rent. You know, some of them were former Pulitzer winners who are now tending bar in Omaha, right? So given that, we were successful for freelancers, but, you know, we had to pay for rent. We had to pay for our health insurance independently. You know, we started to go through our savings when our daughter was born. And I just saw this, I called it the middle class vortex, you know, this sort of fall that we could potentially make if we didn't quickly get normal jobs and figure this out. And, you know, daycare was, costs were piling up. We're in New York City. It's incredibly expensive. And that was really eye-opening. And, I mean, we were lucky. We had the savings to go through, right? And that makes us a rarity in America. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it gave me kind of a window into the experience of many other people. And then I started reporting around the country, seeing people who had a much more, you know, down-to-the-bone experience of being middle class.
But I thought this was interesting because you write that at one point you felt a little sheepish that the two of you had not planned ahead any better. But you also came to feel like the game was rigged. And I imagine everybody listening knows exactly what you're talking about. But tell us, what do you mean that you felt the game was rigged?
Yeah, I mean, you have incredible wealth in this country, people who are not paying taxes at the rate of middle-class people. You see people spending tons of money on daycare and without only 14% get paid leave in this country for pregnancy and, you know, maternity, paternity leave. And so that just, you start to feel like there's just no way to win once you have children and there, unless you are one of the ultra rich. And I think this is the experience that political populism has been tapping into with, to my mind, troubling results, right? Mm-hmm. But we could, you know, there's a new study called the Opportunity Index that found that just 38% of jobs enable workers to afford a middle class life. And that's the rigged part. And, you know, accounting for inflation, Americans have about the same purchasing power they did 40 years ago.
Mm. You know, let me get our listeners involved here because so many of them can relate to what you're talking about here. To what extent are you and your family being squeezed today by the rising cost of healthcare, or maybe it's college or childcare? And how are you dealing with it? And I'm wondering just how frustrated are you with it all? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, Alyssa, you developed this mantra for your book, again, titled Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And your mantra was, it's not your fault. What do you mean, it's not your fault?
Yeah, so my experience when I was reporting this in my own mind, and, you know, when I had my daughter, is that we blame ourselves often. And of course, there's a part of the population that blames other people. And that's led to fear of immigrants and Islamophobia and all sorts of ugly things. But many people who are squeezed in this way are just blaming themselves. They're like, what have I done wrong? Why can't I figure this out? Why are these bills piling up? You know, I just wanted to have kids and a normal job and a pension. And, you know, the American dream has sort of escaped my reach. And so part of what I wanted to do with this book was show how, you know, this kind of sense of it's not your fault. You haven't managed your things doing, you haven't managed your career or your finances well. You can't. In some ways, like, this is rigged, as again. And you need to start looking more broadly out of your personal individual sense of pain and shame and start looking at what are the actual culprits. You know, what has gone on? You know, what kinds of what's happened to your profession? What's happened to taxation? What's happened to, you know, Social Security? Like, all these kind of forms in American life that have led to this.
How should people deal with this idea that there are systemic problems out there that may result in folks, you know, struggling their entire lives with their finances? Because just knowing this is a surefire way for a lot of folks to become bitter, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, I think to me, in some ways, it's a, I call it radical self-help, because I think once you stop blaming yourself, you can start looking at the social fabric, and it's a kind of awakening that a number of people in the book have, and also I personally feel more politically aware than I was, you know, even 5 years ago, and aware of these structures that are. You know, shaping my reality. And once you realize that, at least you can start voting differently. You can reach out to your colleagues and neighbors and, you know, your family and talk about what's going on without this sense of stigma, you know. And that at least produces small bore, you know, changes where you can kind of pool childcare. And I read about some of the fixes, the individual fixes that people reach for. And that's not, you know, optimal. We want to have societal changes, but while we're waiting, while we're organizing for them, there are these smaller ones that people are making, like barter and trade of, you know, daycare and,
right,
you know, meals and housing and living collectively in these small things that they call co-parenting. So anyway, you know, but that starts with you being like, it's not my fault. There's social problems. Now I'm going to be able to talk to my neighbor about this.
Alyssa Quartz, my guest, her new book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And I'm wondering how you're being squeezed these days and what you're doing about it. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What figures do you have for all of this that begin to describe the plight of so many folks in the middle class? Maybe it's how much they earn, how much debt they're carrying. And one number that just, I had never seen it before, this notion that middle class life, you found, Alyssa, is now 30% more expensive than it was 20 years ago. That's just a staggering number to me, and it begins to explain a whole lot here.
Yeah, and the causes of this, a lot of it's higher education. Even public universities have doubled in cost since 1996. And this is like adjusted for inflation. So when we look at private, it's, you know, exponential as well. So then many people are paying their own college debt and paying their kids' college debt as well, right? Or they're in debt for that. And you also have the cost of healthcare, which has risen exponentially. And finally, when you have kids, you have the cost of daycare, which has also risen, you know. Many of the families I spoke to who were ostensibly middle class were spending, you know, 20 to 30% of their income on daycare. And annual averages in the U.S. range from like $11,000 a year to like $30,000 a year.
Is that beginning to affect our birth rate? Are you seeing any numbers that way?
Absolutely. You know, there's a new study from the CDC that there was data that suggested that women were having fewer children than any time since 1978. And that just came out in May. So that's like 1.76 over their lifetime.
People just can't afford kids.
Yeah, you can't afford children. And, you know, and we can't reproduce our even the reality that we experienced, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. You also point out, and this number just caught me, too, 65% of all Americans worry about paying their bills. I mean, that's a lot of people.
Yeah. And there's also a lot of data on people who can't afford to pay a deductible, a $500 deductible. There's some huge, insane number, like somebody floated a number of 73%. I mean, I think people aren't necessarily saving, partially because they can't.
Yeah, to what extent are you surprised that we haven't seen more of a revolution of sorts in the country just about this? We're hearing, you know, lots of talk about the rich, the upper 1%, the upper 5% doing so well, and the rest of us being in a completely different category, facing a completely different reality. But you don't really sense a lot of big changes being made to correct that.
Well, partially, let's look at our leadership right now, you know.
Okay.
On a national level. But locally and statewide, I mean, your recent Kansas election seemed to bear out, at least people want some kind of change.
Yes.
They're you know, reaching for it. Who knows if what will happen? I was listening to you talk to the governor just before, and,
right,
you know, that seems promising. And I think you also see, I mean, in certain pockets, you see millennials joining Democrat Democratic Socialist Organization, the number, the membership went from 6,000 to 47,000 in 2 years. Mm-hmm. So, and that's socialists, you know. So it's sort of an interesting thing. Like, I think there are murmurings, but, you know, the self-blame piece, we have to keep thinking about this. I think it tamps down some of that energy.
What's the toughest part of making ends meet for you and your family these days? 816-235-2888 is the number. Alyssa Quartz, my guest, her new book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. This won't surprise many people at all, but you also point out the cost of health care doubled in the last 20 years.
That's right.
Yeah. So when you compare your life today with the life that your parents provided you, we're talking, as the years pass, two very different experiences, right?
Yeah. I mean, so I've been talking about this, about the middle class as an idea as well as an economic reality. And it was the man in the gray flannel suit, right? It was humdrum. It was almost like you were trapped in this middle class identity, taking the commuter train. This was the mythos of the 60s, you know, the early 60s and the 50s. And now, like, just to be humdrum is like a fantasy that many of us can't mm-hmm. access. And that to be middle class is no longer aligned with stability and banality even. You know, it's like a category filled with contingent work and, you know, long hours, unusual hours, and not a clear life trajectory. And, you know, I think there might be possibility in that. Like, we can become people that, you know, different kinds of people in our lifetime, but it's also a lot of pressure.
Now, we're talking about all this, and I'd be remiss if I didn't point out something else that you make a bold statement about here, which is this notion that all of this is only worse for families of color. I'm wondering how much worse.
Yeah, I mean, I have some of the stats in there, but also anecdotally, when I talk to people of color, they were, you know, laid off from, say, a reporting job after 20 years, this one woman, and she sent out 200 resumes for PR jobs and didn't get a single one. And that just, there's a lot of studies of the amount of bias when, you know, employers see, well, first of all, female, and then a, you know, woman of color, and then someone who may have taken time off to raise their kids. So she wasn't getting any of those jobs. And, you know, she made a remark about that she knew it was because of her age and her race. And I saw it over and over again when I was interviewing people. So there would be marginally more wiggle room for some of the mm-hmm. white parents, you know,
right.
Like they might be able to start over a little more easily.
How are you getting squeezed? That's our topic, our number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some calls here. Rick from Independence. Rick, you're on the air.
Good morning. A good topic. As a retiree, I was prepared. I have a meager pension. But what we're all confronted with is unforeseen circumstances, particularly coming from the economy changes mm-hmm. that no one can foresee. And it can be traced to a source, and it is the change that took place with Ronald Reagan and free market capitalism. That's where this decline began.
Rick, thank you. And Alyssa, it gets to your point, your mantra here, it's not your fault.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these are, yes, Trump is making all this worse, but it starts in like 1979. That's exactly right, with Reaganomics and with, you know, even in the Clinton era, with, you know, aid to dependent families, you know, kind of rerouted into workfare or whatever. You know, there's been a sort of wave of insistence on governmental figures demanding personal responsibility,
right,
whatever that means, and watching that affect, first of all, the working class and now the middle class.
Hmm. Back to some calls here. Drew from Lenexa. Drew, you're on Up to Date with Alyssa Quartz. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to bring up the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which presents the idea that financial education is a bigger part of the problem, that people will spend as much as their paycheck allows and incur more debt as their paycheck increases. And what your thoughts are on financial education is maybe part of the problem.
That's a great point, Drew. How much of all this is self-inflicted, Alyssa?
I think that's completely true. And I think one thing that I've actually had a conversation with somebody at a bank recently about this, like, I think we need to offer, you know, finance classes to young people, you know, and we also need to educate people about having a more defensive attitude towards predatory loan practices, which and now people are using payday loans to pay for their college. So all the things that once afflicted the, you know, working class and working poor people, it's sort of moved up the rung and now is affecting middle class people who, say, are trying to go to college. So it would really be great for there to be some way to teach the parents and the kids about what payday loans are really about. Indeed. But also, you know, again, not to put it all on their at their door and say, look, you've messed up. You know, you're not balancing your bank account properly when sometimes it just isn't any way. The money's just not there, you know, and not to, you know, shame them around it.
Right. Okay. 816-235-2888. Christina from Prairie Village. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, Christina. Thanks for calling.
So my comment is about a situation that I'm in that I think a lot of people have opinions on. So my partner and I, he is 34, I'm 35. We live with his parents in Prairie Village.
Hmm.
We all, so we live with them and help pay their mortgage, and they help us keep from renting and wasting money as we've been. So for a
How's
lot of
that working out for you, Christina?
Well, it comes with a lot of stigma. But I graduated high school, immediately moved out, and went to college and did all the things that I thought would set me up for the middle class standard of living. And unfortunately, between student loans and some health care bills
right.
and paying rent and not, you know, building equity, it just got to a point where it didn't make any sense. Like, rent seems like you're throwing away money, but with all of our debt, we weren't in a position to buy. And his parents are at retirement age, and they're also having, you know, their own financial struggles. So it made more sense for the four of us to share a home. And it seems, you know, somewhat embarrassing to be a 35-year-old and admit that, but I want to take it away. Like, it's not our fault. We did all of the things. We work full-time jobs.
How long have you been doing this, Christina?
It's been a little over a year. Last summer, we made the decision. And it's worked out well for all of us financially. It's just one of those things that you don't expect to be
right.
in your 30s and living at home.
Alyssa, I need to scoot on Christina, but Alyssa, Christina is hardly the first person with this alternative living arrangement that you talk about in the book.
Yeah, I'd, honestly, Christina, if I had met you 3 years ago, I might ask you to be in this book because this is the kind of strategy that you know we're thrown back on, and this is also the kind of stigma that people live with. Like, and I'd love to hear more about. I mean, how do people react to you when you say I'm doing this for financial reasons with living with? Is it your parents or his parents?
Yeah, Christina, how do people react?
It's a mixed bag. I think a lot of people understand where we are at, and then there are some people who think, what's wrong with you? You're too old for that.
Right.
So our friends and family are very positive about it. Nobody, but I know that there are those out there who would probably judge that decision and think, you're too old for that.
Right, right. I'm glad you called, Christina. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Let me get one more call here. Jason from Olathe. Jason, I got about 40 seconds here.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that I don't feel squeezed because specifically, I'm white, I'm male, I'm college educated, and my parents were fortunate enough and worked hard enough to put me into that position to succeed to get a good job. I have a lot of student debt from 2 degrees, but I can pay it because I have a good job. If any of those variables were different, I would be terrified right now.
Good comments, Jason. I really appreciate that phone
that,
call.
That
too.
Had a beautiful kind of pith to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But I mean, that's part of it too. I mean, you mentioned race, but true, there's gender. Women with children earn $11,000 less than childless women.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's Alyssa Quart. Again, her new book, "Squeeze: Why Our Families Can't Afford America." Great conversation, Alyssa. Thanks very much for taking some time with us.
Oh, it was great. Thank you.
On Monday, a guy you may not have heard of, but he's got a lot of sway in these parts. That's former Missouri State Senator Charlie Shields, who now heads the state's Board of Education. He's also CEO of Truman Medical Center. He'll join us on Monday. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Steven Steigman, Berea Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. Thank you.